numbers on. Just got recorded here.
Okay, no, we're good.
They received a report on the district's engineering and compliance division. And that concluded our business for the third.
Great. Thank you. And unless there's any questions from board members or members from the public, don't see any here. Okay. We'll move on to comments, referrals, chair, board members, anything, this be your chance. Okay, great. It's time for Rich, our report from our air pollution control officer. Rich, the floor is yours.
Great, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. I just wanted to give you an update on what's going on at this district. Like many businesses in California, we opened to the public yesterday and we invited staff back in. So staff are currently in the building, but a number of staff have remained at home or will remain home up to 2 days per week as we continue to hybridize our telecommute and on-site work program. So we're seeing how that works. And so far we're following the policy that we had established in the past that the board has had a chance to review. So we'll keep tabs on how that's working and hope to make it a great success. Also wanted to let you know that we've got a number of recruits underway. And sadly, and we haven't done anything as by way of celebration because she's going to be here for another month, but this is Ann's last board meeting. So go dark, yes. So we're going to formally recognize her too. She's got some big shoes to fill, and I'm really happy to announce that we had a lot of great recruits. We've gone through our final round of interviews. We hope to be making an offer soon, and with the intent of having that person have some cross training availability with Ann before she leaves, so she can tell them how she does all the magic. So that's going to be great to have some overlap there. And then in August, you'll have a brand new clerk of the board, and we'll be recognizing Ann at that time too. So we've also conducted a first round of interviews for Scott's old position. And we got some really excellent candidates there too. We're gonna be having a final round of interviews shortly. And then we hope to make an appointment in the next week or two. So we're getting ready also to advertise and recruit for an engineer position. We've been down an engineer over the past year, and I'm sure the engineers would approve that it would be great to have some additional help down there. So we'll start recruiting in the next few weeks with announcements and then conducting interviews. Moving on to our engineering updates, my standing item with the marina odors is that on Memorial Day, we did receive a complaint from somebody out in the East Garrison neighborhood. The winds were generally blowing from the landfill towards East Garrison. So we went through our standard protocols and notifying the appropriate folks and authorities. And it should be noted that we received no other complaints on that day, and we have or during that month regarding marina, landfill, or other sources out there. Also, this is a big shout out to our compliance team for their continued work in making sure our regulations are followed. In May, we referred two cases to the Monterey County District Attorney's Office, which included one case with over 200 identified violations. We also referred another case to the Santa Cruz District Attorney's Office, and we hope that they'll be prosecuting those soon. And with the staff's help, we give them pretty much a turnkey document where they can just integrate that into their case. So thanks to compliance team for their efforts in that. And I just wanted to mention our engineering team provided feedback to the California Department of Food and Agriculture on on-farm composting tool they're developing. The CDFA is creating a spreadsheet tool with requirements from air districts, CalRecycle, and the Water Board to assist farmers in understanding the new requirements and regulations that may apply to different on-farm composting operations. So we're concerned about this from a couple of standpoints. One is odor, of course, and the other one is emissions of vault organics, mainly methane. As I mentioned the last meeting, planning air monitoring update, we held a community air protection program virtual workshop on June 8th to gather input from residents in low-income and disadvantaged communities on how to spend incentive grant funds to reduce air pollution in their neighborhoods. Potential projects could be tractor replacements, electrification of on-road and off-road equipment, improved school filtration systems, and installation of air pollution control devices on stationary equipment. We did a pretty extensive outreach, and we had 6 members of the public show up and provide comments. So that will be integrated into the development of our program. That concludes my report. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Rich. Any board members wish to ask Rich any questions?
Yes, Carbone. I didn't. Yep. Sorry, I didn't raise my hand.
That's okay. Go ahead.
Okay. With the compliance team, there was one business that had 200 identified violations, or was that?
That's correct, and I'm looking towards Amy if I don't remember the particulars.
Yeah, it's actually a business owner that's not actually located in our air district. They rent out portable engines, and so to lots of different locations. So that's why there's so many different violations.
But one business owner well, we can't get into details at this point, but yeah, not a great actor.
Thank you.
Got it. Any other looking real quick? Okay.
Chair, I have my one hand up here. Sorry.
Got it. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
For ask you. Just the June 8th Community Air Protection Program workshop, you mentioned that briefly. I request again that we get the opportunity to be notified of when those meetings are being scheduled, and so that we can help advertise and let people know about the opportunity to participate.
Yes, and I believe we sent you notification for that. So
okay, it is possible I missed it. I was a little tied up this week, but yeah, perfect. Okay, thank you.
Got it. Okay, Zach.
Thank you, Director or Chair McShane. Actually, this is just maybe it's a little bit out of order, but I just want to briefly say, because I think we'll acknowledge her more later. Anne, you're the best. I mean, we absolutely love you, Anne. I mean, the thought of you not being a part of the district is actually pretty heartbreaking to me. But this board loves you. You're the constant when we all change, and we look forward to honoring you more as time moves on. But the wheels turn because of you, and so don't think you get to sneak out without us saying some nice things about you. But you're deeply loved, Anne. We're gonna miss you.
Oh.
Well said.
Thank you. Well said, sir. Okay. Seeing no other hands or comments, we'll just go to the public. If there's any member of the public, very quickly, just looking. Nope. Okay. Great. So we move on to our consent agenda. We have 3 items on the consent agenda. Would any board member like to pull an item from the consent agenda? Okay. Seeing none, just go into the public real quick. No hands. Good. Okay. So we come back to the board looking for a motion for the consent agenda.
I'll move the recommended actions.
Great. So moved by friends, seconded by Askew. Anne, let's call the roll.
And before I do that, Director Carbone did have her hand raised.
Oh, I think she was trying to second it, maybe. But did you unless we, yeah.
Okay.
All right. Well, okay,
let me
good.
Go ahead and call the vote. Excuse me here, I've got to get the right spot. Thank you for your patience.
Can you help?
Could you?
I think Zoom should add a second feature instead of a hand. They should just
there
have
it. Is.
Yeah, so it's my other thing. Okay, when I call your name, please answer in the affirmative or negative. Director Dillis?
Aye.
Director Phillips?
Aye.
Director Kosmicki?
Aye.
Director Carbone?
Aye.
Director Labar?
Aye.
Director Coonerty?
Aye.
Director Story?
Aye.
Director McShane?
Yes.
Director Askew? Director Askew?
Yes. Can you hear me? Yes.
Director Friend?
Aye.
Did I miss anyone? A motion unanimously passes.
Thank you. Okay, we get to our regular agenda, and our next item is the proposed budget for our upcoming fiscal year. This is our second and final public hearing and discussion on the topic. So Rich or Rosa, we'll turn it over to you.
Go ahead, Rosa.
Okay. So good afternoon, members of the board. I'm going to do just a brief presentation and touch on the topics that we, all the changes that we made based on our last presentation. So let me just open up my slide here. Can you guys see that?
Yep. Nope. Yep.
Yep. Okay. Okay. So this is the second public hearing for the draft budget for the fiscal year 21-22. So at last month's meeting, we had our first public hearing for the budget, and we're going to review some of the same details in this presentation. We're going to focus on the budget highlights and the minor changes that were made since last month. If you see on agenda page 58, you'll find a budget in brief. The total budget was $19.7 million. That consisted of $6.6 million in operating costs. Non-operating costs were $13.1 million. So that's CPI for all the fees of 2%. That's what was proposed, except for asbestos. We had the 2% CPI increase to the city and county per capita fees. Our total budgeted full-time employees is going from 29 to 30. We still have one vacant position in the inspector, which we're not going to be filling this year. Then we have our fixed assets that remain the same. It's $150,000. It's for database and document management programs for the cloud services, one compliance vehicle, and the ozone analyzer for the air monitoring division. Then we have the estimated deposit to the OPEB. It's $45,000. So that was a change from the last time. And that's based on the actuarial report. And then the pension trust deposit is going to be about $75,000. And then we have the major grant programs continuing, AB 2766, the AB 923, Carl Moyer, the Woodstove Changeout, and the CAP and Farmer programs. So these are the budget revisions made since the first hearing. So we adjusted the Woodstove Changeout administrative expenses. The total for that program for this upcoming year is $100,000, $87,500 being for the actual wood stove incentive, and $12,500 for admin. Then we decreased the open funding to $45,000 based on the actuarial report recommendation. And then we added the $75,000 to the pension trust. So that we received the final contract for the Moyer grant, and that was an increase of about $70,560. So with those changes, there were some minor updates to all the budget schedules. So those kind of went through all the schedules. So this is the updated pie chart for the revenues. And the only increase to this was the Moyer, which shows in the state grants of is now $3.26 million. This is an updated pie chart for the expenditures. So there was the changes, salaries and benefits, they kind of changed a little bit. And we just moved some stuff around from the wood stove program into the other funds. So our total projected expenses is about $19.7 million. Okay, so this shows the summary of our general fund balance, assuming that all activities in the budget take place as planned. So it shows our estimated beginning balance on July 1st is going to be about $7.622 million. We've got revenues of about $5,000,019 and expenditures of $5.5 million. So we have an estimated ending fund balance about $7 million in the end. So that shows we're still in a pretty healthy position by the end of the year with almost $5.2 million in unreserved and $1.9 million in reserve for special purposes. And that concludes my presentation.
Great.
Is there any questions?
Thank you, Rosa. Just looking for any hands from directors. Oh, there we go. Director Askew.
Thank you. So just want to ask if the board's ever, and I know we're farther in the process on the budget, but if the board's ever had a conversation about policy related to using strategic reserves or using our reserve fund to balance the budget?
I'm not sure. So we do have some reserves for like our building and our OPEB pension funds, but I don't think we have.
Yeah, we've had a number of conversations with the board. We developed a number of reserve policies for setting aside money and so forth. But if your question is specifically to lowering fees using the surplus or something like that, we have not had those types of conversations. We've been trying to, over the years, basically spend the budget down. And in total, we've been unsuccessful with that because we typically end up bringing in high penalty settlements. And so it just bumps that overall budget back up. We've, to your question, we've put together a clean air fund that we now deposit 20% of the monies into that is used for clean air projects. For instance, we're funding a position and a course up at UCSC, which is environmental chemistry. It's over 3 years at about $100,000, $33,000 per year. And we have other projects that we've funded in the past. So we have the opportunity to use this money to provide funding for other clean air related projects. However, we are very concerned that we're looking at a significant decrease in revenue should the Moss Landing power plant shut down, which we think it will in the next year or to three. So at that point, we're gonna have to rely heavily on probably deficit funding until we can make appropriate adjustments to bring revenues back up or cut expenditures.
Okay, and I think that that's what I was getting at was that the budget that's being presented is balanced, but we're using reserve funds. Our expenditures do exceed our revenues. And so I was just wondering, you know, there's a lot of, you know, we're required to pass structurally balanced budgets, some agencies are, via policy. And I was just wondering if that had been a conversation and what the criteria are that the board, if any, has laid out for when it's appropriate to use reserve funds in order to balance an annual budget.
Well, and also to that, we also, if you look at our stationary source program, we've been sued over this issue in the past. And we now include this to document the fact that we cannot over collect fees for our stationary source program on the state side. We can on the federal side. We have a dual permit system of state, and it gets confusing, but for the state, we try to aim low so that we don't overcollect. And so typically you'll see that reflected in our budget. Also, I would just say that as all of you know that these budgets are just estimates and we have no way of knowing how many permits are gonna come through the door next year, as well as how the expenditures are gonna go. We have a pretty good idea, but I'd say in the last 11 budgets I've been involved with, most of them have been deficit budgets. But as I said, we haven't been really successful at spending that money down, although it has been higher in the past. It, when I first got here, I think we had $10 million in the bank.
Okay, thank you.
Cool, thank you. Anybody else questions regarding the item? Okay, just looking really quick. Don't see any other hands raised. Going to the public attendees, okay. Nope. Did we receive anything, Anne? Any written comments?
No, we did not.
Okay, we're back to the board to see if we can get a motion on the item.
I'll move the recommended actions. This is Zach.
Thank you. Moved by Director Friend. Is there a second?
Second, Coonerty.
Seconded by Director Coonerty. We have a motion and a second. Anne, will you call the roll?
Yes, when I call your name, please answer in the affirmative or negative. Director Dillis?
Aye.
Director Phillips?
Aye.
Director Kosmicki?
Aye.
Director Carbone?
Let's see, Marianne?
She might be having some audio. I will come back. I'll come back. I'll go ahead. Director LaBarre?
Aye.
Director Coonerty?
Aye.
Director Story?
Aye.
Director McShane?
Yes.
Director Askew?
Yes.
Director Friend? Zach, you might be on mute. Did you drop off?
Well, he's there.
And Director Carbone? And I know she's trying.
Okay, all right. Our next item is our second and final public hearing on our district fee schedule. So with that, I believe Amy will be presenting.
Correct.
Okay.
Let's see. All right. Good afternoon, directors. So we have not made any changes since our hearing in May. So I'll just briefly go over again what we're proposing for our fee rules. And we're proposing to increase fees within these four rules. And we are proposing to increase those by the consumer price index of 2%. And as I discussed last time, we're looking at adjusting some of the gasoline throughput fee categories, clarifying the toxics fee, and aligning some of the language in our Title V fee rule with Rule 300. So just wanted to start off again with some examples of what does a 2% fee increase look like. And in this table, you can see, depending on the current fee, the 2% increase is a range from $4 to $19. And the column on the right shows what the new fee will be starting July 1 if these changes are approved. Next, as I mentioned, we're looking to align these throughput categories in our gas for our gasoline dispensing facilities with regulatory limits. So different requirements apply to gas stations that have a throughput of greater than 120,000 gallons a year. So that's why we wanted to adjust that first row. And then if you go down to the third row, a different set of requirements called in-station diagnostics are required beginning at 600,000 gallons a year for throughput. So again, we wanted to adjust that category to match that throughput level and that different type of requirement that's placed on a gas station. And so by making these changes, we're aligning these throughput categories with existing regulatory limits. And then we also want to clarify that our toxic program fees apply to every permit. The California Air Resources Board is adopting changes to their criteria and toxics reporting regulation. And with the hundreds of additional toxic chemicals that they've added, this will basically require everyone to be reporting toxics emissions. And so we want to make sure that we're collecting fees to support our toxics program. And as Rosa mentioned, we're proposing not to increase our asbestos NESHAP fees. We did received this one public comment from one of the abatement contractors regarding the fees for the low category being too high. And so we went and looked at other air districts and we did find that San Luis Obispo charges $687 Bay Area charges $754 and our current fee is $806. So we felt like we wanted to leave our fee at $806. So we're proposing not to increase these fees. And then I will also say that we did do in fiscal year 1920, the last time we raised fees on this rule in particular, we did do a 10% increase. And so perhaps we're kind of reached a place where that increase has leveled us off. But we are making one adjustment in this rule to clarify that the cancellation fee applies also to notifications that are just regarding demolition. The way the language is in the rule now, the cancellation fee only applies for notifications for renovations. In this way, it would apply to if it was just a notification for a demolition only. And then finally, in Rule 308, which is the Title V fee rule, we're proposing to delete this language shown here. And this is because this language was removed from Rule 300 in 2018. And we failed to realize it was also duplicated in this rule. So this is just a cleanup for consistency with Rule 300. So our recommendation today is that you adopt the resolution to approve these fee rule changes. So with that, I'll take any questions.
Thank you. Very good. I'm looking right now. Any questions? What is that? Okay. I'm not seeing anybody, but then, yeah. So I think I'm in attendees. Okay, let's go to the public if no board members have questions. Not seeing anybody there. And did we receive any public comment on this?
No, we didn't in my office.
Okay. All right. So this is our second and final public hearing on the matter, and we are looking for a motion.
Move approval, Phillips.
Okay. Is there a second?
Second, Dillis.
Great. Moved by Phillips, seconded by Dillis. And let's go ahead and call the roll.
When I call your name, please answer in the affirmative or negative. Director Dillis?
Yes.
Director Phillips?
Aye.
Director Kosmicki?
Aye.
Director Carbone? Marianne, you're on mute, or if you're here. Director Carbone? I'll come back. Director Labar?
Aye.
Director Coonerty?
Aye.
Director Story?
Aye.
Director McShane?
Yes.
Director Askew?
Aye.
Director Friend?
Aye.
And Director Carbone? Well, the motion passes.
Okay. Next up's a presentation, an e-bike presentation, including some legislation and what's before the Air District. So Rich, the floor is yours.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the board. So as I mentioned last time, the analogy is we're building the airplane as we're flying it. So this is to do with our electric vehicle incentive program and incorporating the electric bicycle incentive portion thereof. I will also say that there's a lot of polarization on this. People actually love this program or they really detest it. And so it doesn't seem like there's too many people in the middle. So we've received comments reflecting that spectrum of polarity. So we're trying to build this the best way we can. And I just say that we probably haven't thought of everything. We have gone out to numerous bodies and cycling committees, that sort of thing, to discuss this. And we've received a lot of comments, many of which Alan will present to you today. But what we're looking for as we move forward and run this program with the start of the new fiscal year, we're looking for direction from the board on some specific topics. And we've tried to recommend where possible what we think would work pretty well. Suffice it to say, this is a pilot program. I think those folks that are dubious about its potential are also you know, they may be partly correct. I'm not sure that we have unlimited resources, although we do have a pretty big budget, but we or fund balance, but we still want to make sure we're getting emission reductions. That's the primary purpose of these types of incentive programs. And we know for sure that when we, take an electric vehicle or put an electric vehicle on the road, we're hopefully taking off a gas-powered vehicle. And some of our other programs have been targeted at diesel and that sort of thing. This is unusual because we're looking to get basically the honor system to work for us, to for people to let us know that they will be getting on their bicycles and out of their cars. And we hope to capture some of that data as well. So without further ado, I'll let Alan get to the program description and then we can have a robust discussion.
Great, thank you, Richard. Welcome everybody back to some sort of normalcy for after COVID. Chairman McShane, members of the board of directors. I'm gonna attempt to do this. I'm not really good at this Zoom stuff, sharing screen, but I'll give it a go, see what happens. Okay, I think this is gonna do it. I sure hope so. Can everybody see that?
Yeah, great okay, job.
Let's see what happens when we start the slideshow. Oh boy. Not working. So let me try another screen. Here, let's try that one. Okay. Well, I'm just gonna go through these one by one, even though I'm not doing this as a slideshow. I don't know what the heck's going on here. Keep trying, diligence. There we go, how's that?
There you go.
Cool. All right, thank you for being patient. As Rich pointed out, we are not experts on e-bikes. So we spent a little time trying to do some research. Here's some pretty pictures. I think they all tell the tale. There are a lot of different configurations of e-bikes, although the state of California and 21 other states recognize only three categories. You can see that this is a step-through bike in a street configuration. Here's a mom and her two kids on a cargo bike. These are obviously trail bikes, mountain-type bikes, and the lower profile street bikes. So one thing that we found out is there is a plethora of configuration of these bikes that are out there. But as I said, the state and 21 other states have codified three classifications, class one, two, and three. The class one and the class two bikes are governed at 20 miles an hour. The class three bike is capable of speeds of 28 miles an hour. That's with motor assist. The biggest distinction between classes is class two. It has an unassisted throttle. So you don't have to pedal to engage the motor. Some of our people that we interviewed about the class two bikes say that these bikes are dangerous simply because if you don't know how to stop it up to 20 miles an hour, you're going to have a tough time with it, especially on a trail. That said, here's some of the legislation in the state of California that's taken place since 2015. AB 1096 was put before the legislature in 2015, and it actually defines legally the term electric bicycle and regulates its use, codified in 2016. What this means is that the class 1, 2, 3 bikes can't have in excess of a 1 horsepower motor attached to it. And class three bikes, which can go 28 miles an hour, are not allowed on bike paths. Later in 2019, Senator Umberg presented SB 400, which added e-bikes as an incentive to the Air Resources Board program called Clean Cars for All. This is a very prescriptive program. It's basically a cash for clunkers. So the way it's designed is to target low-income disadvantaged communities, but they must scrap a vehicle to be a participant in the program. The number of the dollar amount of the car incentives can be as high as $12,500. In the case of the e-bikes, which was authorized in 2019, the four districts that currently participate in Clean Cars for All are Bay Area, San Joaquin, South Coast, and Sacramento. So far, there's only one air district that even has a program, and that's the Bay Area. And they're offering $7,500 grants to low-income families to purchase an electric bike, but they must scrap a car. As I said, pretty prescriptive, pretty much in the pilot stages. This isn't a real popular program yet, but we'll see as time goes on. You've got the California Bike Coalition sponsoring bills like AB 117, which is really pressuring legislation to add e-bike incentives to the state air quality improvement plan. What they're pushing for is an initial allocation of $10 million with an initial incentive at $1,000 per incentive. So that'll get you 10,000 e-bikes on the road. Pretty aggressive request. And that's pending in the legislature. It's slow going. We'll see how it goes. And then lastly, at the federal level, Leon Panetta and one of his other congressmen, Blumenauer, in 2021 have provided legislation called the E-Bike Act. And they're looking to provide a federal tax credit of $1,500 for e-bikes. And that also is pending. And my next slide, we'll talk about where these bikes can go in the state of California. So up at the top, you've got a traditional bicycle, which can pretty much drive anywhere there are roads. And then the class 1 through 3 e-bikes, which have a lot of flexibility, except for class 3, of course, which is not allowed on a bike path. The one thing that's important about this distinction of classes is that the California Vehicle Code does not consider any of these three classes a motorized vehicle like a moped. So you can see that mopeds are a bit more restrictive on bike areas and very, very well regulated by the DMV, but the class 1 through 3 bikes are not, except for the helmet requirement. Staff found a very, very exhaustive and in-depth survey of existing electric bike owners across the entire North American continent, which included Canada. It was done by a couple of gentlemen from Portland State University and also the University of Tennessee. It was grant-funded from the National Institute for Transportation and Communities. Really some interesting information that we were able to glean from this. I'm not sure how well you can see the demarcation of colors on this bar chart, but I think the most important ones to pay attention in the bar graph is this dark blue line, which represents e-bike ownership and e-bike utilization. The next line, which is really a darker red, which doesn't compare well with the lighter red, but the darker red is driving alone in your automobile. So you can see that driving alone in your automobile is still a pretty popular way to get around, except when you get to exercise or recreation. You can see that the top hitter is going to be the e-bike, even more so than the regular bicycle by quite a large margin. But more importantly, back over here to commuting, if you look at that dark blue line at 34% of the current e-bike owners, and this is a sample size of 1796, I call that statistically significant. 34% of the e-bike owners commute with their e-bike. It's pretty telling versus 28% who still drive alone. Personal errands, you can see that driving alone makes a lot more sense than driving your e-bike, because can you imagine going to Costco or buying a heavy, a large appliance and putting that on your cargo bike is going to be a little challenging. So personal errands is still dominated by driving alone in your automobile. E-bike characteristics are something we wanted to look at as well. In other words, what have people bought? So we have our, as I said, there's a plethora of e-bike configurations. A standard e-bike will put in a bunch of the category of it's got two wheels, it's regular size, it looks like a bicycle. The mountain bike configuration, as you probably all well know, fatter tires, little beefier frame. And you can see that these are the most popular configurations that e-bike owners have purchased and are currently using. Another thing that came out of this particular sample is that 85% of all of these e-bike owners that were surveyed bought new e-bikes. They did not configure a standard bike. So people have really, finally in the United States have glommed onto, you know, the e-bike attraction. I want to point out that the e-bike attraction, as it explodes globally, there are several hundred million of these e-bikes around, most of them in Southeast Asia. the United States is probably the slow runner in trying to catch up to the use of e-bikes as alternative transportation. This is kind of a busy chart, but if you look down at the bottom, this was a percent of respondents who were ranking from first, second, or third. Why are you using your e-bike? I think the bottom one, the right here, pretty much tells the tale. It's to replace car trips. So for those first three rankings, most of the respondents said, yep, I'm using it to replace a car trip. And then of course the other ones go hand in hand with the rest of that bar chart. Recreational purposes, obviously you're gonna have much more fun on your bike than you will your automobile. And then the other issue that makes e-bikes so popular is the lack of effort required, less effort required to use these things, especially for the older demographic who may have some physical limitations on riding a bicycle. So this brings us to what we would like to present to the board for guidance on. We're looking to allocate $50,000 from our AB 2766 budget. And with that, we're looking at $200 incentive per applicant. We'll go ahead and double that if the applicant is low income qualified. We'd like to see the purchases be done new from established e-bike retailers. There's a bunch of reasons for that, but the biggest one is we really don't want to incentivize someone from buying something that's just simply a consumer product. A bicycle is a bicycle as long as it stays intact. And most of the e-bike retailers that I've talked to have pretty much said that if you don't buy the bike from us, the e-bike, we're not going to be willing to work on it if there's a problem. So it's all about warranties. And so we want to make sure that the applicants who are incentivized by this are not going to get stuck. So we're just looking out for the consumer at that point. We're looking at limiting the total cost of the e-bike. There are quite a few e-bikes out there that sell for less than $1,000, but they typically don't come from e-bicycle retailers. These are the types of bikes you might find in Walmart or Costco, but certainly not from an actual established bike dealer. And then we were looking at putting a maximum of $4,000. And the reason behind that is it's simply this: you can spend up to $15,000 on a really nice electric bicycle. And I don't think it would be very value added to offer a $200 incentive to someone who's willing to plunk down $15,000. And then another limitation we want to put is just limit the class ones and threes, because the twos tend to be a little nefarious in terms of, are they actually even compliant or legal? And then the type of bike that we would like to incentivize is the commuter bike, which can come in a lot of configurations, as I mentioned, and the cargo bike, which has a distinct utilization for both, not just groceries and hopefully not washing machines, but kids. I mean, they pack very, very well on these cargo bikes. So we would think that these would be pretty popular. And with that, I'm pleased to open this up to questions.
Wow. Well, very good presentation. And I'm sure we'll have plenty of questions and comments. So let's start with Jack, and we'll go from there.
Yeah, thanks for the presentation. I learned a few things. First, but I am wondering, though, what a commuter e-bike is. Cargo seems kind of obvious to me, but I noticed when the survey talked about the different kinds of e-bikes, I didn't see commuter on there. So is commuter just a term meaning those are people that use the e-bike to commute, or is it a specific kind of e-bike? That's my first question.
According to the data in that survey, the answer is yes, Jack. So you could use a number of different configurations to drive to work.
Okay, thanks. And then let's see. I'm happy that the proposed incentive is increased from 150 to 200, but it still seems kind of small to me. And I recognize there's only so much money, but is there flexibility or funding available to push that number higher? And connected to that same question is, I see that the low income, if you're a low income person, you can get twice as much of an incentive, but it seems like those the thresholds for the low income are very low. For instance, for one person, looks like it's $2,004 a month, which is not a lot of money. So my question is, to kind of help the incentive, can we lift those both? Can we have a higher incentive, and could we lift that threshold higher to allow more people to qualify for the low income?
This is probably one of the most common responses from the Regional Transportation Commission in Santa Cruz. Their bike committee has been around for a long time. But as Rich pointed out, and this is really kind of amazing, the answers were all over the place. Some said too high, some said too low. There's just a really wide spectrum of opinion out there. I think that, and I think it really kind of boils around to, are you really a bike enthusiast or are you an e-bike enthusiast? And so I think that's where the distinction came from. But that's what we're seeking guidance from the board. We just based on the information that we were able to find, based on the average cost of e-bikes, what kind of target do we want to go to? Do we want to really focus on low disadvantaged communities? Why, absolutely. Is it still outside of their realm at 200 or 400 to buy a $1,000 e-bike? That's what the pilot program will tell us, I think.
Mm-hmm. Okay. My next question is, I see that you're proposing that the program work only with retailers, and I understand that. I didn't see the word local in there. So was that something you've talked about, whether that should be only local retailers, assuming there are local retailers, and I know they're everywhere that in my area, at least in Santa Cruz County. So what do you think about the idea of saying local retailers to help our local economy and jobs and so forth?
Yeah, I'll jump in, Alan. I think that's the thing that we wanted to have happen, and I apologize it didn't get in there. One of the comments we did receive, however, is that with everything, like everything else, there's an e-bike shortage right now. And so they want to limit it to those dealers that may not have access. So the discussion was go to, you know, Amazon or something like that. But that gets away from, you know, getting a bike that can be worked on by a local shop. So we'll keep that in local. It also keeps the taxes here, which is a little different than the motor vehicle registration for electric vehicles, which actually comes back to the community, even if you buy it out of town. So with the e-bikes, we're gonna shoot for local. And we heard that loud and clear from a number of comments as well.
Okay. And then lastly, I was told that there are other actual and or planned and potential rebates, City of Santa Cruz, 3CE, who might be doing incentives as well. And I'm wondering if the timing of this program could kind of match the timing of other incentives, assuming that is workable and reasonable and near term, just to allow folks to be able to stack those incentives.
Stackable incentives are great, but Rich, I'll let you chime in on that.
We're certainly amenable to stacking different types of programs. I don't think that 3CE is, I'm not going to speak on half of 3CE, but we just discussed the programs they're funding. They're even considering pulling out of the electric vehicle market. So I would be surprised if that actually made it into their program spending. So I think that I've heard Santa Cruz is very interested in that as well. And certainly we could stack on. It's just coordinating the benefit. Mm-hmm. And we like to make these incentives rather than rebates, which is always a real difficult nut to crack, because we want people to go with the idea that they can purchase a bike because we've lowered the cost. Not that, I happen to purchase like I was going to purchase anyways, and I can get additional dollars for that. That's counter to what we're trying to have happen here. So we can certainly coordinate with these other programs and see how it's going. But our anticipated launch date would be consistent and coincident with the electric vehicle incentive program. So we have a lot of work to do in the next month or so to start rolling that out.
Okay, I just have two more questions about the incentive part of that. First, that implies that you'd be working with the retailers, which seems like it'd be easier, particularly with local retailers, which would be good. And secondly, can we make this, I'm a bureaucrat, I've been trained a bureaucrat, but I don't like bureaucracy. Is there a way to keep this as simple as possible so it doesn't become a time drain both for our staff and for the stores as well.
That's a very and very great observation, because that's my primary concern. It's probably going to cost us more to process these applications than the electric vehicles, just because we have so much experience now. And we've automated the process. We've used a laser fiche data management program to really streamline how we give incentives out for the electric vehicles. So we hope to apply that to the electric bike program, but we sort of have to have all the parameters in place before we start designing the automation for that program. And I don't want to, as I've said in the past, take $2 to give $1 away. So we're going to try to make it as streamlined as possible. We had some comments that we should be training people on how to ride these things and providing, you know, education on how to ride a bike. We're happy to provide information, links, or additional documentation with the incentive, but that would just really, I think, be a resource drain to us, and something that I'd rather be, and the board can speak to this, I'd rather personally be giving more money out in rebates than spending it on training that can be accomplished, somebody checking out a video or something like that.
Okay. Thank you.
Good. Let's go to Sam. You're muted, Sam.
Excuse me, thank you. Very informative, but Jack asked all the questions that I was gonna ask. So asked and answered, thank you.
First in his class. All right, Mike LaBarre.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. So there was a couple things that reading through the staff report and then in the presentation I'd like to make recommendations for is Director Rudescu really focused on getting for low income. And I'm worried about the 1,000 to 4,000 threshold. That really isn't a low income price point. It's more middle class. And I did find a couple studies, one that was done in the UK by their transit industry that did show, and this was 2018, that 28% of those who bought e-bikes were to replace or instead of a car. So I think there is data that shows that we can make market significant results with the program. I would feel that it would be much better skewed towards low income. As you had mentioned, right now, e-bikes are selling out of the store as fast as they come in. And the comments from some of the local shops that they don't want to work on any other bikes is more of a way to dominate their segment of the market here. I would definitely look at this program should be 1,000 and under. Force those retailers to have a bike for $999 so that it can be for low income. I would really focus that because I think that's where you can get some work done. I would allow foldable ones. While they're a small segment, foldables are generally used in complement with public transit. And I would allow trikes, and that is because there are a significant number of e-bikes that are bought by 55 and over for health reasons, to do small little commutes, to replace car trips. And trikes can be more feeling a safety net rather than a regular one. So I'd expand the definition of allowable bikes to include those two because they have cross purposes. I would definitely encourage us focusing the 200, 400 rebates on 1,000 and under, and really highlight getting people who normally could not afford this to afford it, because then you're pushing it into a mid-range mountain bike, regular mountain bike cost. So then there's competition. I would also allow places like Amazon, some recognized online retailers, because we will get the sales tax from that retail sale from the internet. but it would have to include whatever the return policy is. The discount could not be paid out until after that return policy is done. I think it's well worth doing a pilot project. And again, thank Director Rudisku for bringing this forward and moving it forward. I would just like to see those types of changes. Thank you.
Great. Director Friend.
Thank you, Chair. And also thank you to Director Dillis for sort of setting the stage on this one today. I mean, I have to be direct that I'm pretty dubious that this is going to be an effective program in reducing carbon emissions for one, or really being successful in getting people to change behaviors or really incent those that don't have the funds. As somebody who represents a district with a significant amount of disadvantaged residents, I mean, it seems a little bit preposterous that somebody's going to buy a bike that's over $1,000. And so what I think that we would do is the following. I think that, and I heard what Mayor LaBarre was saying. I also think, by the way, that Europe and Asia are fundamentally different infrastructures and densities than here. And so, you know, I would take a study in those areas with a grain of salt. I mean, we have 600 square miles of roads in Santa Cruz County. We have about four times that in Monterey County. And the idea that somebody's going to be commuting to an agricultural job in my district using an e-bike seems pretty preposterous to me. So I think that this is an air district. And at the end of the day, we're supposed to be reducing carbon emissions. And that's why the electric vehicle incentive makes sense. This, I think, doesn't make sense from an air district perspective. With that said, I mean, I understand the point of a pilot project, but we should be going into it with an honest assessment of why we're here. I mean, the AB 2766 had a very specific component. I understand that this is being allowed, but you know, I sit every year and have to listen to Alan score these projects that come in for carbon reductions and whether the roundabout works, and some of our real important political pet projects don't get recommended for funding, and yet we're taking $50,000 off the top for something that none of us can honestly say will reduce carbon emissions throughout this region. So it's just something to be honest about as an air district. Is it a feel-good policy? Is it something that we want to be able to have a checkbox to say we added some sort of incentive program? Are we actually trying to reduce emissions and change behaviors? Because even the data on the massive, on the meta study to some degree that you have presented, Alan, showed that of those that had a bike, only about a third were actually using it as their commute. So you start doing the math on this, right? And you start saying, how many people are going to even take this up? What's the demographic of those that are going to take it up? Is it going to be the people that can already afford to buy it, to Mayor LaBarre's point, or are we actually trying to incent those that can't? Of those, what percentage are actually going to use it then as a transfer of their commute methods? And I think you start getting down to a pretty de minimis number, and therefore basically an unmeasurable impact on CO2 reduction. So I can support a pilot program, but I could only support it if there was a pretty massive shift in what the allocation toward a disadvantaged status would be. Those numbers, by the way, are partnered with the 3CE numbers anyway, for those that apply for those that status through them. So I would say that to Mayor LaBarre's point, I don't think it has to be a cheaper bike. I think it has to be a much higher incentive for a disadvantaged person. So for example, you can buy a $1,500 or $2,000 bike if you're giving them a $2,000 incentive, right? I mean, that's not the issue. To me, I'm fine with that. I mean, and why should I also say that, you know, you matter less to buying an expensive bike? You should only get an inexpensive bike, and therefore we're going to help incent that. But I think that as somebody who has the means should be getting a you know, basically no incentive from our, because they're going to get it anyway. This is not a recreational tool. I'm not trying to encourage people to use this as a recreational tool. And I don't think Director Askew, to some of her earlier points, well, this is about trying to shift behaviors, and this is about setting that expectation. I don't think, as this is currently presented, it does that. I'm not supportive of sort of the current. I'm not supportive of the structure as is. I would need to see a much significant, a much higher investment for disadvantaged communities. I'd like to have us not just do what typical happens in government agencies, where we create a pilot program just to make it a permanent basis. I mean, this has to be an honest analysis 12 months from now as to whether this did anything. With a true measurement of CO2 reduction, like we do on all the other AB 2766, this should be scored against every other project that comes forward on us, so the board can make a determination of where it would rank. I already know where it's going to rank. It's going to rank, it wouldn't normally rank high enough for funding. So I think that as long as we're willing to accept those things, that it's not going to change the CO2 component, it's probably not going to really alter behaviors. Realistically, we're not going to see a lot of people in Seaside Marina or areas of Watsonville or Pajaro or these things really uptaking these components. And I agree with Jack that it should be local. I mean, if we're you know, you've heard me say this nonstop on the vehicle incentive. If we're going to be spending money in this area, it should be to small, locally owned businesses. It shouldn't be going to Amazon. Those are things I think that we can say, well, we won on the local component of it. We also increased sort of awareness of it by having an incentive program that gets media coverage, and there's value in that, but it's not a CO2 reduction. So, I mean, I'll be interested to see where we land as a board as far as direction goes. And by the way, today was just to receive the report, it looks like, on the direction. So I don't really know where we're supposed to provide the input beyond just this commentary. But those are my concerns moving forward with a $50,000 investment, is that it really isn't going to move the needle on the things that this commission, or excuse me, this district is actually directed to do. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Alan, for the report as well.
You bet. Yeah, we have some more commentary. I'm still at Central Coast Community Energy. We had a, I don't know, nearly a 4.5 hour meeting today. And there was a lady that phoned in under public comment that really doesn't like electric school buses. She's like, it is the worst waste of public dollars because they run in the morning and they run in the afternoon and they sit idle in the summer. She's like, you want to reduce greenhouse gases, like you could do more. Yeah, I think there's more to this. And that's where I guess we'll hear from Director Askew, because, you know, maybe there's changes and behavior that can be brought about. Let's see, Director Askew.
Yeah, thank you. I just want to say, Richard, thank you. I think this was one of the first conversations we had as a new board member earlier this year, or maybe it was even last year. I don't recall. It's been a blur of a year, but you know, and I just want to say thank you for hearing, you know, hearing the interest and then finding the ways to, you know, bring it forward for the board to have these kinds of conversations. I think it's helpful, and so just wanted to say thank you to you and to your team. In my experience, there's sort of all of these tensions that are playing out. And on one level, it's like the more people that are on bikes, the safer it is for people to be on bikes, and the better infrastructure we're going to have for bikes, which is going to allow more people to be safe on bikes. And so for me, I have a tension between thinking what the outcomes of the program that we want to be achieving. And I definitely am coming at this from a perspective of, you know, changing behavior and structuring something in a way that allows people to have an alternative to their vehicle that's safe and achieves our goals. And so the concern, Director Friend, that you mentioned about how do we measure that? Like, how do we account to ensure that we're developing a program that's actually going to change the behavior that people have? How do we plan on evaluating? Do we need to put any of these funds aside for evaluation? And how do we typically do that?
Okay, well, I can answer the last part first. Typically our funds are for direct emission reductions. So we tried to get away from doing a lot of studies because they end up not going anywhere and costing a lot of money. We've done that before. We have actual bicycle experience because we've paid Ambeg, we've paid TAMS, and we've paid a lot of folks to do studies on bike paths and transportation routes and congestion management. And at the end of the day, we're really not any farther ahead. So I would also just say that the more bikes we have, we're going to start taxing our infrastructure. A number of the comments we've received, which I think are legitimate, is that if we start congesting our bike lanes with electric powered vehicles, it's going to be problematic because they weren't designed for typically large amounts of traffic or congestion, and the safety issues because people get on that don't have a lot of experience and they could end up wreaking havoc for other riders. So I think all comments are legitimate, and especially like training, I think that's a big component. But that's not going to get us any emission reductions if we train people, if we do an additional study. But we were thinking of incorporating into the program some sort of diagnostics. So at the end of the year, we can sort of go through, and it's not going to be super scientific, but we could try to ascertain how many people left their vehicles at home. We could make that a requirement of taking the incentive that you provide a report, a feedback. Of course, once they're gone, we have no way of really enforcing that. But, you know, and also we wanted a commitment from the rider that they are using this to replace a car trip or vehicle miles traveled. And we could, at the time they do the incentive, have them estimate how many miles they think they're going to be displacing. Uh-huh. And that's on the honor system. So we're trying to think all this through, think again of the airplane flying. I think we got a couple of wings on, so we need to get the tail section developed and we can steer it a little better. So yeah, that's why I say, you know, at the end of the day, we may learn that, oh boy, we blew it really bad. There's all these things we didn't think of, but that's why we're trying to be very prescriptive with respect to how it works. And we don't throw too much money at it and then find out that, well, that was really not a good idea. If we find out that we really need to put more money in and it's really successful, I'd be the first one to lead the charge. So I think that's where we stand. Hopefully I answered a lot of your questions.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just thinking that there are a lot of people paying attention right now to e-bikes. You've got federal incentive rebates. You've got other districts looking at rebates. I've been contacted by a handful of people that are excited to hear that there's, you know, discussions taking place locally here on the Central Coast. And so I want, you know, just I'll throw this out there and we can maybe if it sounds interesting to staff to pursue, you know, I know that there are many of our local university professors and students who are always looking for good projects. And this may be something that catches their attention and would generate interest. The results of anything that they're able to come up with would generate interest far beyond our local boundaries. I mean, we're looking to, what did you say? Where did that study come from, Mayor LaBarre? East Asia or Europe? You know, we don't have good data here locally. And so part of, I think, what my goal is would be, you know, if this is really not the way to go, then it's really not the way to go. But if there is data to be gleaned, that would help us sort of with the bigger picture goals. Just a couple follow-up comments. I do think that the higher incentive amount is something that would make sense because if targeting our lower income residents who are more likely to utilize an e-bike for transportation purposes, who wouldn't otherwise have the ability to purchase one, does make sense to me. And I also represent a district, Director Friend, where, you know, many of my residents are disadvantaged, are using public transportation for their, to get to and from work. And we do also live, my district, I've got some great infrastructure in place. I have a bike path that is underutilized with a four tag program that's coming in and people are talking about it. So I see huge opportunities with our college, with our students, with our hospitality workforce, where we do have some major traffic issues for our low income workers to take advantage of a rebate program to purchase a bike that they wouldn't otherwise be able to access. So reducing that, reducing the minimum bike cost, I think is one piece of that. Although I hear the other argument on the other side, but reducing, so I'd be supportive of reducing the minimum cost of a bike. I would be supportive of increasing the incentive for our lower income residents. Which I think we're both, Jack, you'd mentioned both of those things. And then I think Director LaBarre also mentioned reducing the minimum bike cost. I would also support Director LaBarre's suggestion about allowing outside retailers like Amazon, Costco, or, you know, reputable retailers of these products. And we know that there are more coming online over the next year. And I would hate to exclude a good product, you know, that maybe came from Costco because it came from Costco. If there's hundreds of thousands of bikes coming out of Costco, our local bike shops are going to have to, someone's going to have to figure out how to work on those products. So I think getting them out is important. I support the suggestion of allowing affordable bikes and trikes. And I think those were my big, and then those were all of my notes here.
Thank you, Director.
And again, just want to say thank you for pulling the project together and for the opportunity to provide some feedback.
You bet. Thanks for the creativity. Very, very, it's good. We're coming up on 2:45. I want to just make sure we're mindful of time. So we have a couple of people and then at least one in the audience. So let's go to Director Phillips and then Director Coonerty, if that's cool.
Yeah, I'm kind of in the middle. I see Wendy's position. She has an e-bike, and where she lives, she can use it to get to work. And some of these isn't going to be an all or nothing. I mean, someone may choose to use it 3 days a week and not 2 days a week. I got an e-bike a month or so ago, and out where I live, I got it just because I want to try it out. Out where I live, I have to put it in the truck and travel 5 miles before I can use it on it. Yet when my grandson was over looking at it, I may give it to him for he's in University of Arizona. It would be ideal for him to use it for transportation. So it depends on where you live. Like what Zach was talking about, if you're out in the agriculture area or out where I am in Hills of Prunedale, they're probably not going to be used for that. But I got mine for I got one of the cheaper ones. That's all my wife would let me spend, but I got one for $800 and it's a better quality on Amazon. It's a better quality than I thought I was going to get for $800. So anyway, those are my thoughts.
Thank you, Director Phillips. Director Coonerty.
Thank you. It's been a good discussion. Trying to address some of the concerns. I think one thing I'd suggest is, given the demand right now for e-bikes, it may be worthwhile for this pilot just to have it be a low income program because there's just such a waiting list. I think we have to be careful with stacking incentives, that you don't create an incentive for people to go out, buy e-bikes and then resell them given the market demand. So I think we have to watch that. I think the point about data is really important. And I'd say over the long, and you know, maybe not this year, but going forward, we are looking at in Santa Cruz County, a shared mobility program across the county. And if we offer a low-income membership and can help subsidize that, those apps will track exactly how many miles those e-bikes were used for, where people went, what time of day they went. So we would actually could use some of that technology and on a shared mobility platform to see what the usage was and what it was. And it would be obviously no staff time for us. But I think there is a huge demand. I think, you know, my district, low income people who are working minimum wage jobs in restaurants and retail, and are looking to minimize transportation costs, this would be an attractive solution for them in lieu of a car. And I could see it working, but maybe this year try it for just with targeted to a low income population. And then in the future years, look at tying it into a more shared mobility platform.
Thank you, Director Coonerty. Colin.
Thank you. I'll be quick. I just want to echo some of the thoughts. I support this program. I think it really needs to be focused on the low-income population. Just to jump off of Director Phillips' comments, you know, I'm thinking if you're out in the country and you're miles away from infrastructure, you probably don't need the incentive. And then as far as Director Friend's thoughts on carbon emissions, I would prefer really just looking more at macro data as opposed to micro data. It's really going to be implausible to really come away after a year with any sort of data that shows carbon emissions have gone down specifically from this program. But I mean, I think if macro data shows that buying e-bikes is a net positive, then, you know, we should pursue this program. And I think that is the case. Thank you.
Great. Thank you, Colin. Just want to go out to the public. I know we have one here, Piet.
Hi, good afternoon, Air District board members and staff. Thanks for this discussion. I'm excited that the Air District is looking at this. Ecology Action actually ran a successful e-bike rebate program in Santa Cruz County from 2000 to 2007, thanks to Air District funding and other funding. So 1,600 people took advantage of that program. They went through a two-hour training before they purchased the bikes. We coordinated with local bike shops. So they were on board. They were you know, brought in before the program was implemented, so they helped design it. So I think there's a lot of benefit to working with local bike shops, maybe, you know, having them match some of the incentive, you know, that we're bringing to the table is a potential. I also agree with all the comments in terms of talking to the bike industry that, you know, there's a high demand. So, you know, the longer you can wait on this program when demand, you know, supply issue is supply is short, demand is high. So soon the supply will meet that demand. So, you know, the longer you can wait on that, the better. And then in terms of partner coordination, the city of Santa Cruz is planning a pilot program in the fall, September, October, to do that. It has an equity focus also. And they are meeting with 3CE staff to talk about that. So there is some discussion at 3CE about an e-bike rebate program. Not sure what that is exactly. And then also I'd like to say that once you start getting too low price point, the quality of the bike really diminishes. I mean, there are some of the bike industry that thinks you need to spend upwards of $2,000 to buy a high quality bike, right? So if you get in cheap, your product's not gonna last long. The idea is get folks on e-bikes, have them replace car trips and do it for 1 year, 2 year, 5 years, 10 years, right? So that's the goal. And there are lots of high quality products out that can do that. So, and then I also would, you know, ask that the Air District, you know, work with Ecology Action. We have experience, you know, we're working with the city currently.
It's in the chat though, right? Oh, yeah,
the kind of stuff. So I think e-bike training is really crucial. You know, you just, you know, they are a different type of product than a bike. And many of these people haven't been on bikes in a while. So if you give them the skills, the confidence and knowledge, they'll not only ride, but they'll ride more often. They won't be spooked when they have that first kind of uncomfortable encounter. They'll also be more conscientious and respectful and careful and safe with other road users. So, you know, the area jurisdictions are investing a lot in active transportation infrastructure, bike paths, protected bike lanes. And I think that electric bike rebates really reduce a barrier to entry to ownership. And I think also targeting low income folks is important. It is a hard to reach audience. So you do need to invest more. So maybe there's collaboration they're working on. You know, we're in Watsonville and Salinas right now doing a CARB funded, you know, community assessment of what kind of shared electric micromobility might be good for folks in those communities, in low income communities.
So, thank you very much. Yeah, very, very good, Piet, and well received. This is obviously a topic of great interest, and given it's an information item, we will we'll continue to digest it and see where it goes from here. Rich, final comments before we close out this item.
Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I heard a lot of really great comments, and I expected to hear that. I do like the idea of targeting it for low income. The one thing I just want to be wary of, I'm sure my folks over at the Mass Transit are a little bit concerned, especially when we talk about pulling people off Mass Transit or buses so that they can't have their own electric bike. The idea there is to get more people onto Mass Transit so they can have more effective and efficient routes. So maybe there's something we can do with the bus folks and provide for carriers for these electric bikes. And then finally, I wasn't going to say this, but I got to say it now. As a former professional bike mechanic, I spent most of my college career working and racing bikes. I got to say that we turn away department store bikes because not because we wanted to capture the market, because they weren't really, we couldn't work on them. They weren't designed to be repaired, and it would cost to fix them is to buy a new one. And I know there's a bunch of bikes right now at Costco for $300. I don't think that they have tiny wheels. I don't think they're really intended as a means of transporting people for commuting. They're sort of novel. And I think somebody who wants to ride one down the street every so often, it might be a fun toy, but I think we need to set some more parameters there. I like the suggestion of working with the shops on developing programs. So having said all that, we've heard the board members and your comments, and they were all good. And what we're gonna do is we're gonna go back to the airplane and start putting the parts on. We won't be releasing this, if it's okay with the board, until probably we after we meet in our August board meeting, and we'll present a final plan for you. I think we have time on our side, which was also one of the comments, especially with the supply. So we don't have to be in too much of a hurry, and we want to get it right, even though it's a pilot program.
Excellent. Thank you, Rich. Thanks for the discussion. And you know, I'm told we do not have closed session, so this might be our last item. Seeing no other business before the board, I just want to thank everybody for attending. We are off next month, so we'll see you in August. It might be a hybrid meeting. We'll let you know. All right. Thanks for attending.
Thank you.
We stand adjourned.